Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, the city of Colchester. You weren't a city last time I was here. Welcome to the Mercury Theatre. Please welcome a man who's feeling dizzy, but he's still coming on. It's Richard Herring. Thank you very much. Oh, thank you. Oh, lovely to be back. Thank you very much. Lovely to be in this beautiful theatre, beautiful city. I've been walking around today having a lovely time. I might collapse. I'm a little bit dizzy. Let's see what happens. Luckily, I'm sitting down for most of the show, but it should be fine. Welcome to Richard Herring's Legendary Sight of a Table podcast. Some people believe Colchester is the site of Camelot, the legendary court of King Arthur. He had a round table. I was trying to do... I needed a spherical table. I thought it's close. No. It used to be called Camelodunum. So, you know, that's Camelot, it could be. Well, if only I had an historian on who could say what a lump of shit that idea was. Let's see what happens. It was Britain's first Roman city, Pliny the Elder. named it. I'm going to just give you a lot of facts about Colchester. It's very exciting. Although I was hanging around with the big lady outside the Fenwick earlier today, trying to chat her up. Didn't say a word to me. It's because I'm too short, isn't it? It's always the tall girls. Don't give me the time of day. She didn't say anything, but the man with the cup said he called it Rahalastapas. So don't know if that's going to catch on. Here's some facts about Colchester. Yeah, on the 2021 census, it says there's 130,245 people living in Colchester. Not bad. I would just, if I was you, I'd be trying to make it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, wouldn't you? It's so close. And you know, you'd only have to kill 6,789 people. 6, 7, 8, 9. I mean, that's freaky, right? It'd be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6, 7, 8, 9. Fuck.
It's almost worth doing, isn't it? I can find 7,000 of you worth killing. Not only do you pretend King Arthur came here, didn't exist, you also think that 3 nursery rhymes came from Colchester. Absolute bullshit. Old King Cole. Humpty Dumpty, which either named after a cannon, which was I thought, or a royalist sniper called One-Eyed Thompson, who fell off a tower. You know all about this guy, One-Eyed Thompson? Did he have one eye, or was he just, like, called that because he was always looking down the rifle with his one eye? You don't know much, do you? Right, I'm going to ask you some questions, Colchester, because I Google Colchester, and then when you Google something, a load of questions come up. And so I'm going to let the people of Colchester answer these questions for the people who are Googling Colchester. First question that came up was, is Colchester worth a visit? Which is slightly passive-aggressive, isn't it? Is it worth it? No. I think it is. It's good. There's a big water tower and stuff. Some Roman stuff. Second question, what's special about Colchester? Is Colchester a nice place to live? No, yeah, seems all right. My favourite question, is Colchester classed as London? No, it's not. Dream on, Colchester. Just because you've been made a city. This, again, just some facts for you. In the book 1984, Colchester was the scene of a nuclear detonation. So George Orwell fucking hates you guys, isn't it? It's what I don't want you to do to George Orwell. That's like when I play Civilization, you can get the atomic bomb comes. It's really good fun to blow up places you don't like. So never blown up Colchester, but I'll give it a go. Darren Day was born here. More about him next week. And Boadicea, so loved the place. She destroyed it in AD 61. Someone buried their treasure underneath Fenwick, didn't they? Then got killed. Very, very exciting, very interesting find that. But, you know, it's the greatest person, greatest woman, I think, in English history, certainly one of the great heroes of English history, came to Colchester and just levelled the place. I think that says a lot. All right, so let's crack on. We've got a fantastic guest for you this week. She's probably best known for playing Mary Beard on the TV show W1A. I wonder how she came up with that crazy character. Will you please welcome Mary Beard, ladies and gentlemen? Mary Beard. Oh, you can sit down. Mary Beard. Actual Mary Beard. Hello, Mary Beard.
Oh, it's great to be here.
It's lovely to be here. What were you doing on W1A? Do you remember that?
I had a cameo role.
Yes.
That meant I didn't have to say anything.
Okay.
The scene was a party, a kind of BBC party, and I was, you know, receiving glasses of wine, et cetera, et cetera. And then the Welsh woman, whose name I can't now remember, came up and started to talk to me. And her punchline was, well, we can't all look like Lucy Worsley, can we?
Oh.
And I was very brave. Yeah, very brave.
Well, so in the last year's rehearsals, thank you, I'd grown my hair pretty long. As long as your hair. And I decided to get cut when someone said you look like Mary Beard. So there you go. It's which I take as a compliment. But the problem as an aging man with hair is you do start to look like someone's nan. That's the problem. So that's the issue.
I don't think you get the kind of shit that I get, though.
No,
you know?
That's definitely true. Definitely true. This is going to be a Rehulstaber book club. It's a very refined. So we're going to talk. We'll talk outside of this as well, but we'll talk about your book. First of all, I have to ask you: is Colchester really the site of Camelot, the legendary made up court of King Arthur?
You don't really want me to answer.
I'd really do.
In fact, I said to him in the green room, don't ask me about Camelot. You know, well, I was obviously an utter provocation. But I think if you want a quick answer, it's no.
Okay, no.
Right, okay.
Probably no. We're no one's sure. No one can be sure about it. If you find a big round table under...
I, I'm sure. I am sure.
You're sure, OK.
Yeah, I'm sure. Camelot never existed, so it can't be, you know.
I mean, you know, that's... You know, they can prove anything with facts, can't you? That's the
that's what I do for a living. Prove things with facts.
But big Roman history, Boadicea, I know you know about that.
Yeah, I thought... I did want to kind of pick you up on one thing.
Yeah, Boadicea?
Well, not that, actually. I mean, we don't know what she called herself. Okay. I mean, the Romans called her Boadicea, and I rather like that, but probably it was Vovdica or whatever.
Okay.
But we don't know whether it was 61 or 62 AD.
Oh, okay.
And that means a lot.
It does mean
that
a lot.
That means a lot to some of us.
Well, you know, you've been working on it a long time. You should know by now, Mary. That's what I should have worked it out.
Look, I know that I don't know because I've been working on it for a very long time, right?
Even with Pompeii, you don't know what the date of Pompeii's eruption was for sure.
No, we don't. I mean, we always used to say it was in August, August 79. And that's because, you know, your friend Pliny... Well, we thought he said it was in August 79. You know, he might have done, but, you know, the manuscripts are very, you know, the technical stuff says are a bit dubious. This is actually quite an interesting point about new archaeology, because archaeologists have discovered that they can capture the seeds and the flora and fauna that were in the environment at the moment that Pompeii was destroyed. And it looks much more like October.
Right.
Now, I got into terrible trouble once with a load of bioarchaeologists saying, didn't actually think it made very much difference. You know, August, October, I mean... Same year and it's completely nuked. But
nice to give the people another couple of months of life, though, isn't it? At least they lived a couple more months before they got evaporated.
Well, you know, maybe October's better. But it just shows how clever archaeologists now are.
It's unbelievable. I can't believe that stuff. I mean, I'm obsessed with it. I've had a few people on the book club who are bioarchaeologists and bioarchaeologists, the teeth. You can tell where people were born from what's in their teeth.
That is what is really amazing, that the traces of the environment that you were living in when your permanent teeth were forming, underneath your milk teeth, remain in your mouth forever. Tis truly amazing.
Yeah. And underground, when your teeth go underground.
And when they remain forever. You don't have to be alive. They're still there. And so you can say, it's not quite as precise as some people like to think, but you can say that if we were to take Colchester, for example, you could say this person spent their formative years in a place that wasn't so cold and rainy as Colchester. Now, that could have been the Isle of Wight, or it could have been the south of France, but you can actually track them, track their environmental history. It is amazing.
Colchester's one of the least wet places in the United Kingdom. That's one of the facts that I... One of the facts that I didn't give you before this.
Can't be true.
It's because the temperate weather comes across the channel.
I don't believe that. I've just been
It's
here.
On Wikipedia. That's as far as my research on Colchester went. Let's talk about... Look, I've always loved your books. I think I've got all of your books. But I may be wrong, but I've... it took me a long time to read SPQR. I bought SPQR in 4 formats, I think. I did finally.
Don't put the audience off.
It was good. It's just, there's a lot there.
It's too good.
There's a lot there.
Yeah.
And I think when I find the audiobook is when I finally settled. So the audiobook is a way to get through. Because look, that's a lot of reading.
That's in the new one.
That's the new one.
I bought a copy too.
There's two of these.
Yeah, just two.
But I love this book, The Emperor of Rome, which is... will you explain what would you say is what you're doing here?
What it does is, you know, I think it's surprisingly radical, though I think you won't sound that when I say. It says, look, how do we get taught to study the Roman Empire, you know, Julius Caesar, the Emperor Augustus, Tiberius, etc. We get taught to kind of mug up individual emperors one by one, you know, Augustus, the founder of the dynasty, Tiberius, the hypocrite, Caligula, the psychopath, Claudius, the studious old duffer, Nero, the narcissist, you know, and so on. And we do it biographically. Now, some of that's, it can be quite fun, but I think it's also terribly sort of exclusive. And, I mean, I think we were taught, I was taught, you know, to think that, you know, you couldn't understand the Roman Empire and how it was ruled if you didn't know when Marcus Aurelius came and whether he was before Antoninus Pius or not.
Yeah.
Now, what I wanted to say in this book is, look, these individual guys don't matter very much. If you don't know whether Marcus Aurelius came before Antoninus Pius, he was actually after, but, well, you're in the same boat as most Romans,
yeah,
honestly, because they didn't know the order of the emperors. They didn't know these individual micro-histories. So instead of saying, you know, and now we're on to Galba, of whom no one has heard, you know, why not say, look, actually, they're much of a muchness, honestly. These emperors, one after the next, are more similar than they are different. And you can ask much more interesting questions, like, so what did they do all day? You know, what did they eat? Who did they sleep with? How did they get around? Who did the filing in the imperial palace, right? And you can say, well, really it's a book which sort of reconstructs the job description,
yeah,
of being a Roman emperor. How did they get their letters? You know, something nasty was happening in Colchester. How the hell did they deal with it?
Yeah.
And for me, that's just so much more interesting than wondering about, you know, what happened in 61 or 62.
Yes. You know? Well, you're the one who brought that up.
No, I know. I did, because... That is true, because
I should have just said that when you said that to me.
Yeah,
I'm more interested, you know, in how they found out.
Just occasionally, you know, a little bit of pedantry escapes. But the book tries to be non-pedantic and to say, wow, you know, that how do you picture a Roman emperor? Well, we kind of usually picture him, and they're all him, you know, doing naughty things in swimming pools. Yeah. And well, they did a bit of that, I think, probably a little bit of that. But mostly, they sit. You know, what do? They sit answering letters all day.
Yeah.
And, you know, the naughty things in the swimming pools are only what they do in the very, very few hours of the day that they're not writing letters.
Yeah, I mean, it's the book makes it clear, and if you think about it for a second, it's obviously a pretty horrible job, despite having all the, you know, the power, supposedly. You know, the chances of you being knocked off are pretty high.
They don't usually end well.
No.
A few of them end well. And that's, of course, quite interesting, because the Roman Empire, one-man rule, the autocracy of Rome, is terribly resilient as a system. Yeah. You know, from Julius Caesar, well, if you take the East, you know, up to the 15th century... nobody really challenges that idea of one-man rule as being the way to do it. But they challenge individual rulers all the time.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, more of them end badly than kind of, you know, float away on their bed feeling a bit dizzy. You know, yeah, that's not what most Roman emperors do, I'm afraid. You know,
I'd like to go float away on my bed talking to Mary Beard. That would be quite a good death if it happens. Put the podcast out.
They're all kind of amazing. I mean, and their last words are always extraordinary. I'll give you one totally unknown Roman emperor, but who has some really poignant last words. It's the Emperor Gator, of whom nobody has heard. Who was a short-term ruler with his brother Caracalla, who decided to get rid of him. In fact, they'd already quarrelled, So they divided the imperial palace up into a kind of multiple occupancy palace, putting a wall down so that Caracalla had one half and Gaeta had the other half. And in the end, Caracalla decides to get rid of Gaeta, and he does it while Gaeta is sitting, he's quite a young lad, on his mother's lap. In the palace. And Gaeta's last words, and I don't know whether this is complete pathetic pathos or whether it's really tragic, Gaeta's last words were apparently, "Mummy, mummy, I'm being murdered."
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I mean, the stories of the... You do detail... I mean, I thought I knew a bit about Rome, but you talk about a lot of emperors I've never heard of. Elagabalus.
My very favourite emperor.
So he's a good example. He's a very young...
he's a teenager.
Emperor,
he's
14 to 18.
Yes.
But the stories about him are kind of wild. The various ways, the things he did to entertain himself from...
And they're wonderfully wild and totally, I'm sure, totally untrue, but totally revealing at the same time.
I mean,
when Mr. Trump was president, and I'm going to say for the first time, hoping that that isn't an awful prophecy, all kinds of journalists used to ring up, it was the age of the phone back then, and they would say, "What Roman emperor is Donald Trump most like?" Yeah. And I would always say, "Elagabalus." And I did that not because I thought even Trump was like Elagabalus, but because I thought no one's ever heard of Elagabalus. So, you know, and the journalists would always say, "Ella," that's spelt with a G. And I knew they'd then have to go and Google him, you know. So, and so I kind of became quite fond of Elagabalus for that reason. But he is, you know, he is the classic awful emperor who rules in the early 3rd century CE for just 4 years. And, you know, if you think Nero and Caligula are bad, you know, they're pussycats compared with Elagabalus. And he, you know, he has an Imelda Marcos tendency. Yeah. He never wears the same pair of shoes twice, right? He's also a bit of a jokester, because he's only a kid, really. So he invents the whoopee cushion. That's one of his inventions. You go to dinner with Elagabalus, and you're sitting on inflatable cushions, and he has his slaves go round and let the air out of the cushions while you're sitting there, and you end up on the floor. And, you know, he's actually pretty kind of... adventurous with his kind of dinner regime. So he has things like all blue dinners, everything is blue, or all red dinners. Or he only invites all his guests have got hernias. I mean, you can see, I mean, I said he's a teenager. or they're all very, very fat, so they can't fit on the couches. Yeah. And then everybody has a huge laugh when they kind of fall off, right? But his most famous trick was he invites his friends to dinner, and at the end of the evening, like Romans often did, he had rose petals showered over them from the ceiling. Except in Elagabalus's case, he was so generous with the rose petals that they smothered and died, right? Now, I'm going to allow myself one academic point here, that mostly people, scholars, have spent fruitlessly the time they've devoted to Elagabalus trying to work out whether this could possibly be true. Now, I think it's much easier to say none of this is true. This is a construction of a bad emperor. But, and this in some ways is, you know, is the serious point in the book, that what these stories do is they say, how do people imagine what an emperor does at the absolute extremes? And what does that tell you? And I think the rose petal story is quite nice, and it's quite a serious one, because it's saying, look, when emperors try to be generous, they kill you. You know? You know, they really do kill with kindness. And there's this kind of... So you get there that kind of sense that it's all jolly japes and it's good celebrity gossip, et cetera, et cetera, but there's an underlying point.
Yeah.
That the emperor is you can't trust the emperor even when he's being nice to you.
And I suppose, you know, it's anyone put in that position, especially like a teenager, would behave awfully. But anyone who was given that amount of power and that amount of, you know, that they could do things like that, they could invite, they could do pranks, and they could they could, you know, have orgies, and they could do whatever they want. They'd be tempted to push things to extremes. Well,
that's the fantasy. That's what we think. You know, like Imelda Marcos.
So then, if all the stories, if you are an emperor, and then they say, well, this is what happened to this Caligula who did all this, then you might go, oh well, maybe I won't do that because then I'll end up being murdered in a horrible way.
Sometimes I think Elagabalus was probably a sort of, you know, a little sweetie pie who hadn't grown up. You know, did get married four times, but. You know, we don't quite know why it didn't work out. Yeah. But in a sense, it's telling you about ordinary Romans much more than Elagabalus. Just like what we say about Harry and Meghan tells us much more about us than it does about them.
Yeah.
Some of it may be true, some of it isn't true. We don't know. But how do we imagine we would behave if we were Harry?
Yeah.
And I think there's, you know, how do we imagine that we would behave if we could sleep with anybody in the world? We had so much money and power, we could do anything that we wanted to.
You could just grab them by the pussy, couldn't you? That's what you could do.
I think Elagabalus did a bit of grabbing by the pussy. I think that.
But you know, you do see in more modern history, you do see people abusing the position of power. So some of these Roman emperors, there's going to be some truth in it, right? They're probably. There's probably a little scintilla of truth in some of it. Maybe.
In some of it. I think the issue, though, is, you know, you can sit down and you can spend a lifetime trying to work out which of these stories is true or not, and you still won't know at the end of it. Right. So I think it's much more interesting to say, why are they telling that story? What's that story about?
Yeah.
You know? And then you start, you really do get a kind of insight into the power of the emperor. I mean, Nero is a good example of this, you know, because Nero, you know, his big fault was wanting to be an actor, Right? That's what Nero wanted to be. He wanted to be on stage, he wanted to be a lyre player, etc. And he was so desperate to have an audience that he would do things like, I mean, I hope this isn't happening here, by the way. He would lock the doors of the theatre so you couldn't get out till he'd finished, right?
As long as you've got their money, they can go when they like. That's right. Off you go.
Yeah, Nero, I think, gave it for free. How unlike us. But there was said to be, you know, women gave birth in the theatre because they couldn't get out. You know, men pretended to be dead so that they could be kind of wheeled out. And, you know, all of this, I have to say, they're jolly good japes and they're good stories. And then you think, a bit like with the Elagabalus story, what underlies that? You know, what's that about? And I think it's about something that we still think about. It's about, is the emperor just an actor? What do we think the emperor is? Maybe it's all a charade. And I thought that very, very strongly. I don't know if you remember this photograph, but when Rishi Sunak was photographed filling up his car with petrol, yeah, right? And he was trying to say to us, we're all in the same boat with rising fuel prices. Right, and we looked at this car, and, you know, it was much smaller than anything that Sunak would ever drive. He clearly didn't really know how to work a petrol pump, let alone, you know, where you went to pay for the petrol. And the photograph became a sign that he was just pretending. You know, he isn't like us. He's just acting up with a borrowed car, not quite knowing where you put the thing in, the whatever. And I thought, we still have that problem, you know. Is all of Sunak just pretense? And how do we feel about that? Yeah. And that's the same story as the Nero story.
Yeah, you know, that is, and I think you're talking about how the image of each Caesar and each emperor, you know, the statues and stuff are basically the same one with a bit chipped off, and, you know, they don't even bother making a new one. They just make it look a bit more like the other guy, but they look so similar, it doesn't really matter.
They're much better than us, much more imaginative about kind of cancel culture. You know, you've got, you know, Nero, there he is, got, you know, you've just commissioned in, you know, could be Colchester, you just commissioned a nice new statue of Nero. Then Nero's overthrown. You know, new man on the block is, you know, completely different in political style from Nero, and you just spent all this money on your Nero statue. What do? You get a chisel out and you turn it into the face of the next guy.
Yeah.
Right? And in a way, that's saying, you know, emperors are much of a muchness. You know, just get, you know, if you want to change one into the next, it just needs a bit of tap away with a chisel.
Yeah.
You know, we get terribly, you know, worried about it. You know, should we take this statue down, put it in the river, put it in the museum, whatever? We could just chip away and turn it into somebody else.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that with Colston.
Yeah, who do you want to change Colston into? Yeah, Lenny Henry?
Well, Lenny Henry, I mean, you know, that would have been appropriate. Not inappropriate. Instead, we get all the natties, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe we should just, you know, take the chisel out.
Yeah. I mean, but again, I suppose that they must have known that, though. So each emperor must have known that that happened to the last emperor, that they did that to the last emperor. A, they know they killed the last emperor, so someone's going to kill them. B, they know they chiseled the face off the last emperor, so someone's going to do it to them. So occasionally there'll be, you know, what I think is remarkable, especially about the Roman era, because it's so long ago. And then we look at medieval times, and especially certainly early medieval times, there's so little source material and stuff. With this book and with your podcast that you've recently done, you can find out so much about individuals and things because, you know, I suppose Augustus is it with the big, this is what I did.
Yeah.
He'll put that up so that he knows that that survives after he dies.
Yeah, the, you know, first proper emperor, Julius Caesar, isn't quite an emperor yet. But Augustus, first, you know, emperor who establishes the regime, you know, he puts up a vast inscription on his tomb, outside his tomb, yeah, saying exactly what he did as a sort of job description for the future.
Yeah.
And there's a huge amount of chutzpah there. But I think the thing that I kind of came to see was that you look at these guys, and it is partly about power. It's part, you know, you're partly looking at people trying to establish themselves. But you also, through these emperors, you see in wonderful kind of, and through a magnifying lens, you see the lives of the ordinary people of Rome too. And you partly do that because Roman emperors, you know, one of the brand images of the Roman emperor is that he should solve everybody's problems, right? You know, the Roman emperor is there for you, right? Now, it's a bit of a myth, but it's quite an important myth in Rome. You know, so Hadrian goes out one day on his horse and a peasant woman comes up to him and says, "Excuse me, emperor, I've got a problem." And he says, "Too busy, sorry, too busy." She says, "If you're too busy for me, you're too busy to be emperor," right? So you are seeing, partly because they're written down on papyrus or inscriptions, you know, people are bringing their problems to Roman emperors, and through their eyes, you see the kind of nightlife, for example, in towns of the Roman world where nasty things happen. You know, and there's an example I use in this, which, you know, always kind of seemed to me to be, you know, just a wonderful idea of what sort of thing the Roman emperor has to deal with. Because a case comes to Augustus from the city of Cnidos, which is on the coast of modern Turkey. And basically, it's a case of two families in the city roughing each other up. And at a certain point, one family, when their house is being attacked by the other, say to the slave, their slave, "Go upstairs and throw the contents of that chamber pot over those guys' heads," right? Yeah. That'll send them up, you know, that'll send them packing, right? The slave does it, but the slave also drops the chamber pot, which kills one of the guys underneath, yeah. Right? Now, the local authority says, homicide, right? And the slave isn't prosecuted for homicide, his owners are prosecuted for homicide. They somehow, hundreds of miles away, they take this case to Augustus and say, "We're being prosecuted for homicide and we're going to put it to you." And, you know, you've got this image of this town racked with, flying chamber pots and, you know, a whole lot of other things. Yeah. And then Augustus sits down, or some kind of advisor of Augustus sits down, reads through the documents, decides what to do, and says, "Actually, I don't think it's homicide. I think it's justifiable self-defense." Right? Yeah. And they get off.
Yeah.
Now, you think, that's the Roman emperor. You know, and our image of the Roman emperor is kind of, you know, directing major issues of military policy. "I think I'm going to invade Dacia," you know, this kind of stuff. Actually, they're dealing with cases of falling chamber pots. You know, and that is the bread and butter of what they do day after day. It's not invading Dacia, it's chamber pots and their contents.
But how does, you know, obviously not everything survive. Does the story of that survive just through chance, or is it because it's a funny story, or is it, you know, just that we happen to find that piece of papyrus?
It survives because the people who Augustus says, "Not guilty,
yeah.
You're not guilty, it's justifiable self-defence," they go back home and they get a great block of marble and they inscribe, or they have inscribed on it,
yeah,
Augustus's judgment, because they want to say to the people in their town, "He let us off." So you get this kind of sense of, this is what the emperor said to me, and we can now, it happens to survive, and we can read it.
Yeah.
You know, people, I think, often get the impression because, ancient historians, modern ancient historians, are quite good at keeping some of the best bits to themselves. You know, people think it's only, we only know about these people through, you know, big historians, Tacitus or the biographer Suetonius. But we've got scraps of evidence,
yeah,
from everywhere, you know, and sometimes it's Roman Egypt, it's on papyrus, but often it's on inscriptions where people are so keen to say that the emperor came down on their side that they spend hundreds of quid, basically, what must have been hundreds of quid, having the judgment inscribed.
Yeah.
And it's a window onto the world of the Roman people we think we don't have.
It's sort of amazing that they did that. I mean, in the podcast, is it a podcast or a radio series, but I listened to it as a podcast.
Both. Yeah, it's both. The BBC no longer really... No, I shouldn't say this because I'll be quoted. The BBC are absolutely a wonderful institution and they're getting into podcasts.
Yes.
But they are also Radio 4 programmes. Yes.
So it's called Being Roman. And with that, you know, there's, I think, like often on a tomb, there's so much more information than you would imagine would be put on it. You know, what we get on our tomb is when we were born, when we died, if we had a kid.
Yeah.
You know, it might be one word about what we did. But, you know, these tombs that
Richard
often turn
Herring,
up...
comedian.
Yeah, maybe. Right. It's comedian in inverted commas. if Twitter's allowed to write my my gravestone. But, you know, like, a lot of these things are found... And I like they're sort of found in walls and things and bits of masonry. So, you know...
They were often, you know, Roman tombstones are often found reused because they're good blocks of marble.
Yeah.
And somebody comes along later, builds them into a medieval church, and then we find them, you know, hundreds of years after that. But they're terribly wonderfully loquacious.
Yeah.
And the series we did on Radio 4, which you can still get on Sounds, just took some of these and said, look, you know, here, one of my favourites, was a tombstone of an 11-year-old lad who had not quite but nearly won a poetry competition, right? In front of the Emperor Domitian, not a nice emperor. And he was aged 11 and he then fell down dead. It's mum and dad on the tombstone say that he's brilliant, he had an absolutely fantastic career, but he died of overwork, right? Now, you kind of think he probably died of pushy parents, would be more like.
Yeah.
But what they do is they got a picture of him on the tombstone and he's looking all very posh in his toga and then they praise him to the skies. Most of the tombstone is actually covered with the text of the poem that he nearly won the competition with. Right? And it's the only poem by a child that survives from the ancient world. And it's not that good, but it's better than what I could do. He did it in Greek, you know.
And improvised.
Apparently improvised. Yeah. And what I can understand, if it was improvised, where do they get the text from?
The guy with the stone.
Yeah, go quickly, yes, writing it down.
Maybe he had to do, that's what killed him. He had to do it as he was improvising.
You know, and he's performing in front of thousands. And, you know, you suddenly see the world of the ambitious family, the kid, you know? Yeah. And it's the kind of thing that we've always been taught to say doesn't survive from the ancient world. All you can get from the ancient world, people say, is, you know, you get the stories of, you know, generals and emperors, and it's always the posh white guys that you know about. Actually, the kind of evidence that you get goes right down to 11-year-old poets or, you know, women whose kind of childlessness is lamented on their tombstone. I mean, there's kind of issues about fertility paraded, you know, in their epitaphs.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, it's lovely. I mean, the kind of history I love, it's extraordinary. But it's exciting to think, I mean, both the things you mentioned, I think those two were, or certainly a couple of the ones in this radio series, were sort of discovered, you know, when like walls fell down or when things were blown up and then they're inside stuff.
Yeah.
So there's presumably loads of these
these
monuments hidden away in various places that will be discovered and also documents. I know in Herculaneum they're just, you know, there's that library full of
there is it's
that they're starting to decode.
I have to say, don't get your hopes up.
I've got my hopes up.
No, don't. it is truly wonderful that this villa just outside Herculaneum, the neighbouring town to Pompeii, is the only place where what was clearly an ancient library survived. But it survived so that all the scrolls kind of got carbonized by the volcanic debris. Yeah. And it was discovered in the 18th century, and people have always wanted to unroll the scrolls. They tried to early on, because they completely wrecked them by trying to unroll them. And, you know, computer technology and a bit of AI is helping us read these. The only trouble is, you know, we would like to think, here are some of the lost poems of Sappho, you know, or the lost books of Livy, or Nero's mum's autobiography, which she wrote, and it's my, you know, that's the one I'd like, and it would. 99% of the scrolls that have been unrolled or computerized unrolled are by a third-rate philosopher called Philodemus. And the last one that's been all over the papers, thought, right, another book, and everybody's thinking, yeah, maybe this would be really interesting. And it's another bloody work of Philodemus. Presumably, the person who owned this library was dead keen on Philodemus.
He might have been Philodemus. He might have been Philodemus' mum.
Yeah, his mum.
Keeping a copy of his bits and bobs. But things, you know, things turn up in, you know, old libraries on the back of, you know, like being reused. Was that the most?
They're turning up all the time. I mean, there's one of the kind of least well-known but ought to be much better-known writers from the ancient world is a doctor called Galen.
Yeah. Now, from Planet of the Apes as well. He's in Planet of the Apes. He's very well-known. He's in Planet of the Apes. He's two characters in Planet of the Apes.
Is he? Thank you. Thank you. Sorry. I'll reuse that. He is so prolific. He writes in Greek. He is so prolific that 10% of all surviving ancient Greek literature is actually written by Galen, right? And it's things like On the Aorta and, you know, On the Principles of the Stomach and things like that. It's medical writing, yeah. Highly technical medical writing. But just occasionally he kind of opens up about all sorts of other things. He's actually the doctor to the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, and he describes how he gives Marcus Aurelius an anal suppository, which I've always thought was the first known anal suppository in the West, I think, administered by Galen to Marcus Aurelius. But quite extraordinarily, only about 20 years ago, there was a graduate student in a Greek monastery library, and he was going through the manuscripts in this monastery library. He was waiting for what he really wanted to be brought up. And he looked at this and thought, he must have been a rather learned graduate student. He said, bloody hell, that's a lost work of Galen, right? And it was a lost work of Galen, in which Galen, who had had most of his possessions destroyed in a major fire in Rome at the end of the second century, writes a short essay trying to come to terms with the loss of his possessions on how to transcend grief.
Yeah.
And that had been sitting there for hundreds of years in plain sight until a French grad student happens to notice it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that the stuff like that comes up all the time.
Yeah, and there must be
loads of it.
I mean, it's because, I suppose, the reason I'd say, like, Anglo-Saxon England, you might not find much stuff, is because Anglo-Saxon England's all in one place. Whereas it's a place where everyone's fighting each other and burning stuff. Whereas Rome was pretty big. So even if everything got wiped out in Rome, there was the eastern part of the Roman Empire where things would survive.
And, you know, the stuff from Rome and Egypt were, you know, what was written on papyrus, buried in sand, just survives. You know, and so you just get the contents of the waste paper baskets. And, you know, that's another guy that we looked at in our Being Roman series. It's a kind of series of what would now be done by email. It's a series of basically the ancient equivalent of emails. A poor, kind of rather grumpy middle manager in Roman Egypt who is trying to organise a visit of the Emperor Diocletian. And he's got to get, you know, and it makes organising a visit of the king now look like child's play. You know, he's got to get the bakery done. He's got to kind of work out how many pigs he needs in order to feed this unknown-sized imperial party. And he's sitting there in his office, firing off. And he's saying to the people in the nearby village, get the bakery set up. And they write back and say, well, I don't think it's our business to get the bakery. You know, it's not. And you know, we never asked Diocletian to come. You know, why should we do this? And you have just a few days of this poor bugger's frustrated emails about how to get this visit organised. We don't know what happened in the end because it just breaks off. We don't actually even know if Diocletian ever went there. You know, it could have been he was expected but never showed up.
Yeah.
But, and for me, it's exciting because it's what we're told doesn't exist. You know, and well, it's taken me about 50 years almost of being a professional classicist to see that this stuff does exist. We can get to this.
Yeah.
It isn't, you know, I'm quite interested in the top guys and the generals, so, you know, and I'm interested in what elite Romans wrote. They're very smart often. But to be able to see that with the real life of these people,
yeah,
it's... You know, it keeps you going for a whole lifetime.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, it's I just love... I mean, I love it when history... You know, history should be about people and you should be touched by the humanity and the humour across the years. I love the bit in the book about the graffito of the first ever depiction of the crucifixion known of.
Yeah, it's a bit hard to date, but probably the first known depiction of the crucifixion was actually, must have been others, but this is the first known one, was actually done by a slave in the Roman imperial palace. And it's extraordinary because it got a cross and there's Jesus on the cross, but Jesus has got a donkey's head. And there's a guy underneath, praying to Jesus in a kind of ancient way of prayer, which is kind of putting his hands up. And there's a little bit of writing in Greek which says, Alexamenos, guy's name, is worshipping his God. Now, it's a piss take.
Yeah.
You know, that there's one slave has got a fellow slave who's a Christian. And they think this is really barking mad. And so they do, you know, he does a little picture of Alexamenos worshipping a donkey. Now, who would ever have thought that the first known representation of the crucifixion was a parody?
Yeah.
It's already a parody.
Yeah.
And it's already hostile. And also, it's quite interesting that the imperial slaves are cottoning on to Christianity long before the emperors are. You know, emperors, meanwhile, are actually killing the Christians. But in the downstairs at the palace, there's young guys who are worshipping said donkeys.
And how delighted would you be to know that your bit of graffiti taking the piss out of your mate lasted 2,000 years and people were still mentioning his name and calling him a dick? That would be just the best thing, wouldn't it?
But, you know, and some of them, I think, are kind of touching. I went to look, there's one part of the Roman Imperial Palace where you can still see these graffiti. And they're very faint, but you can. And I went up to have a look at it a couple of months ago. And we were looking at this one, which has been taken to a museum, the crucifixion, is very famous. But we went down to look at the others in this slave quarters. And there was... Mostly, or some of it is kind of Roman filth. You know, Roman slaves were just as filthy and smutty as their masters, and there's plenty of penises all around this place. But there was also a guy who said that he came from, just signed his name, said he came from Kherson in Ukraine. And you thought, blimey, that's a kind of geopolitical match. He'd be amazed. Yeah. To think that we were still talking, although in a rather very uncomfortable way,
yeah.
that we're talking about the place that this guy proudly said he came from. And you think there's a sort of sense that you are kind of reaching out over centuries to some guy who says, I come from Ukraine.
Yeah. No, it's terrific. The book's really lovely, and, you know, and you're... It does, you know, you think about it, it covers stuff you don't think about, like emperors going on holiday and what that would involve and what emperors did in their spare time.
That's very interesting, I can tell you.
Yeah, and, you know, what people ate and, you know, but exactly that, finding these, I think both these together, the podcast and the book, you know, give you a lovely glimpse. I mean, you know, it's supposedly men think about the Roman Empire more than they think about sex. Nowadays.
Do we believe that?
I don't know if that's quite true, but they think about it. That's the
15 times argument. A day. Yeah. There was this extraordinary TikTok.
I think about Romans having sex 15 times a day, so I can just keep them both going at the same time.
I think about the Romans all the time. Yeah. You know?
You're the outlier of being a woman who does it, but it's meant to be men. Who...
Yeah, and why do you think they do it? I mean, I think they do think about it. So it's a safe space for fantasizing about sex. I think it's also a safe space for... You know, being macho.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I think about the Roman Empire. They don't think I might be a slave in the Roman Empire. They think about, you know, zapping the Gauls, yes, and, you know, wearing those silly little military skirts, swashbuckling, you know, through. And it's fine. You know, somehow it's all right to say, I think about the Roman Empire lots, because it's so far away. You know, you couldn't say without getting arrested, I think about the Third Reich 15 times a day. You know, that would not be. You know, but you can say it about the Roman Empire.
Yeah, and you know, I just think I just can't get over throughout all your work, but obviously all the other work of all the amazing historians who've covered this period, just how much information we've got. You know, for something that should be. You know, I mean, I especially love it when you pinpoints, well, on one of the radio shows, it's about a man marrying a woman who was probably his slave or was his slave, but you find probably both of their tombs,
and
just the idea that they both those both still exist and they were together, however weird the relationship may have been, is really lovely.
And he's on Hadrian's Wall, but he comes from Syria.
Yeah.
So, you know, when people say, you know, there was no migration to this country, you know, until the 1950s, well, Baratais from Palmyra is a good example of a very early bit of migration. What he was doing on Hadrian's Wall, we don't know.
No. It's lovely, and it's lovely to think of those things surviving and, you know, how it happened,
I mean, he puts up a tombstone to his dead wife, who comes from she's kind of Essex girl, really, and she's called Queenie Regina. And he says that she was an ex-slave, and it's only a few lines of Latin. And the bottom, he's got just a few words of Aramaic, saying Barates in grief, alas, right? And I just think, who the hell? In South Shields. Who the hell in South Shields, in the middle of the second century, could inscribe words in Aramaic?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it's extraordinary. I better ask you a couple of merch questions before we go. I've got to, because, you know, you were on I think, the 18th episode of this podcast, and we've had a few since then. So thank you for trusting us and coming on early. So I haven't asked you loads of things, and I have to ask you this emergency question, which is if all the art galleries and I presume museums in the world, maybe for you, got together and said we'd like to give you one item that you're allowed to keep from any museum. I mean, it's a hard question for you, Mary. Is there any artefact that you would like to own or that you would like to take away and have as your own, or is there one thing that you particularly like out of everything you've...
Can I say, I mean, I said this when I did Desert Island Discs.
All right, okay. That's fine.
And I think that...
More people listen to this.
Please...
So this will get there.
Please, can you not put it in the local paper? And be very careful what I'm going to say. I'd like just to borrow the Parthenon marbles for a little while. I will give them back. I only want... I just borrow them for just a few hours.
Yeah.
All right? and then give them wherever they should go back. Yes. Which, of course, is a very much debated question.
Good. Very good answer. Mary Beard, if you could go into a chrysalis, and like a caterpillar, and dissolve and come out as anything you wanted, what would you choose to emerge from the caterpillar at the chrysalis?
Does it have to be human?
It could be anything you want.
Oh, blimey.
Doesn't even have to be alive. It could be anything.
Oh. I think I'd like to be a cat.
Would you?
Actually.
Yeah, okay.
You know, a rather posh cat. Pampered, well-looked-after cat.
Okay.
You know? Well, I didn't have to bother about, you know, killing things and finding food.
There'd be some whiskers for you.
Yeah, I was, you know, it was all kind of, you know, pre-prepared food, you know, kind of.
Did you say that on Desert Island Discs?
I didn't say it on Desert Island Discs.
Good.
They didn't ask.
That's why this is better. This is why this is better than Desert Island Discs. Cool. Look, do you know what's coming next? Are you working? You must be working on your next book.
Do you know, I'm having a bit of time off.
Are you?
Yeah. You know, look, I'm nearly 70. You know, you don't plan for the future when you're nearly 70. You think, well, maybe when the time comes, I might do something else. But actually, I'm having a little... Well, I'm doing things like this.
Yeah, good.
You know, which is fun. If there was a serious thing that I'm going to do, is going to be a little book on what is the point of studying Latin and Greek.
Okay.
It'll be brief.
Well, I wish that's my regret is that I did. We had Latin at our school. We had, just as like a throwback, I think, and we had an amazing Latin teacher, Mr. Moore, who I thought was about 70, but I think he's still alive. So he must
28.
He had grey hair, so I thought he must be real. I think he's still alive, but he was a wonderful teacher, and he really got me into Latin. And it would have been very useful for me to carry on Latin, and I stopped because I wasn't allowed to do it with my O level choices. That's how old I am. That's history, O levels. I kind of regret, you know, Caecilius, Estin, Archie,
Estin,
all that
Horto.
Stuff. Yeah, so I missed, you know, I'd like to go back to that. I went ahead in all those books. I loved them so much. I bought them. You can buy them still, but I couldn't get my head around it now.
It's not too late, Richard.
It is. It's too late. And, and also, you can just do it on a computer now, can't you? It'll just tell you. Just a voice will go, yeah, this is this, just what does this mean? This means this. It'll be a.
Yeah,
I'm not going to, you know.
Don't believe him. Don't believe him.
But look, I really, really appreciate you coming on the podcast. It's lovely to see you. It's always lovely to see you. And do go and if you want to buy, I absolutely recommend. Are they selling all your books out there? There are loads of them.
They're selling loads of books. They're all signed, and you can get it dedicated. But we've got to be quick, because we can't have the audience not getting back in time for the second half.
I mean, you've got a whole week till next week's show, Mary, so it should be, there's a whole week. Shouldn't take too long. But thanks so much, and I really massively recommend the book and the podcast and whatever comes next. And SPQR is great as well. It just took me a long time to find the right format. Daz Boot, I've got in four formats, and I've never watched a fucking second of it. I've got the book, I've got the DVD, I've got the extended DVD, I've got the video. Never watched a fucking bit of it. So I've got through SPQR. And that's what you want to hear as an author. I've got through it. It's brilliant as well. And the book on Pompeii, which is the first book I read of yours, is absolutely amazing as well. So, ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for the amazing Mary Beard! See you next week. Thanks, Mary. You have been listening to Rahalastapa Book Club with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Mary Beard. Thank you to Scant Regard for providing the music. We don't usually have that on the book club. It's nice, isn't it? I'm indebted to my friend and producer, Chris Evans, not that one. Thank you also to Beck Cliff and George Lingford for all their very hard work on tour. Thank you to everyone at the Mercury Theatre in Colchester and everyone who came. It was such a delight. This is a Sky Potato Fuss and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can, and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.